It's okay with Melissa. I will introduce our speaker. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Kevin.
Kevin, alcoholic.
I was just thinking to myself, tonight, not if, but when I lose my train of thought, I'm going to point to Al.
Al, what am I talking about?
Be on your toes, brother. It's going to happen. My sobriety day is January 23rd, 2012. My sponsor is Luke V, and my home group is the Ghost Team Lakes Group, and then Stag on Thursday night. That's right. I want to say happy birthday to Gil. He's only a birthday guy right off the bat, and welcome to the newcomers. You know, if you're new or fairly new, I hope you find what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like I say, you know, bring the body and the mind to follow, you know. I'm still waiting for mine to show up, you know. They just wander around the parking lot over a Big Five or something, you know. But, so, where's my criers at? We got any criers in here? Come on, it's the program of original honesty. Come on, get them up. David's not here, so he texted me, so told me he was here, but it's kind of funny. My girlfriend busts me crying watching TV all the time. And, yeah, she's usually all, oh, you're so cute, that doesn't be good. She busts me another night crying on the episode of Bar Rescue, you know. It's an alcoholic thing, you know. But American Idol. What's that one with the box? Undercover box, all that. You know, I'm just like falling my eyes. You know, a couple months back, we're watching this movie, you know, and she looks at me and she's all, "Babe, are you crying right now?" I'm like, "No, I'm a big fan of Michael." But babe, you know, this guy's been looking for his family this whole movie. He finally found his mom and dad, you know, and they don't want him. I can relate, you know. She's all, "Babe, it's Joe Dirt." Actually, I'm telling the truth. I was crying. A little bit about myself. We'll talk about me now. We got that out of the way. I wanted to talk a little bit about my childhood because I think it's important. It was pretty traumatic for me. I had a pretty traumatic childhood. And I was taken from my mom when I was 8 years old. My little brother was 5. And at that time I didn't know my real father. And I was put into the system. You know, we went to a big receiving home. It was kind of like an orphanage, you know. And then they took us way out in the country and put us in a emergency foster care home. And that was just a real traumatic experience for me, being 8 years old and taken from my mom. And she had a mental breakdown, and turns out that she was diagnosed schizophrenic and had to be taken care of in, like, boarding care homes, you know, for basically the rest of her life, you know. And so we went out to this foster home, and you know, it was terrifying. There was kids everywhere. They had their own kids, too, some grown kids. They were in their 20s, older foster brothers, and then I had one that was like the same age as me. But they, like I said, they were emergency foster care, so they would keep kids for 6 months, and if they didn't have no place to place them, you know, they'd keep extend it for another 6 months, you know, and like me and my little brother, they couldn't, there was, I guess I kind of felt like nobody wanted us, you know. So they just kept upping it another 6 months. You know, and during this time, they would bring my mom out to see me and my little brother, you know, and that was, like, really super hard on me. Like every, like, 3 months, they'd bring her out to see us, you know. And in that 3 months, it was, like, enough time for me to, like, build up some walls, you know, to protect myself and then I would see her, and then those walls would just come crumbling down, and I would just go lock myself in the bathroom and cry because I couldn't face her. I didn't want to feel that pain all over again, you know. So early on, I developed tools for living, you know, like put up walls to protect yourself, you know. Don't let nobody in because people are going to hurt you, you know. Guard your heart, you know, and that's kind of the way I came up as a child, you know. And also in that home, there was a lot of abuse, you know. My foster parents had wild kids that were just crazy. My oldest brother was a biker, and my second oldest foster brother was a carnie, and they were constantly in and out of jail with drugs and weapons and different charges, you know. And they loved to just give us drugs and get us all high when we were young and laugh at us, and we'd freak out and have anxiety attacks and stuff. And also in that family, they, you know, there was a lot of child molestation that went on, you know, and me and my little brother got the brunt of that, you know. And it wasn't like, oh, it happened once or twice, you know, or 10 or 20. It was a normal thing that, you know, that's just when I was a little kid, that's just what was going on. And that was my reality, you know. So, you know, there was that side of it, and then there was also the other side of it that, you know, they decided to stop taking other foster kids and just keep my little brother and I and raise us, you know. And my parents were good enough people. They weren't the ones doing the molesting and all that. It was other family members, you know. But I had a host of friends that I'm still best friends with today, because, like, my friends kind of became my family. I attached myself to them, you know, and they kind of became my family. And it was like about five guys, and we're still best friends to this day, which is really cool. And so there was another side of my childhood where we were, like, running around our bicycles or our fishing poles out in the country, just running them up, doing whatever we want, as kids do, you know. As long as I worked really hard at home, then my foster dad would reward us and let us just go play and do whatever, you know. So during that time, my oldest brother, he played guitar, and I had aspirations ever since I was a little kid to be a rock star, you know. I wanted to be a rock star. So I got a guitar and I started playing guitar and bass and got in a band in high school, and you know, I was doing all that. I was growing up, and I had really long hair, and my foster dad was a Korean War vet. He was really like a Korean War hero. This guy was like gnarly. He was hard, and he told me, you know, when I was 16, you look like a girl. Get your damn hair cut or get the hell out of my house. So I had really long hair back then. There was no way in hell I was going to cut my hair, you know. So I was like, okay, I'm out. So at 16 years old, I moved out of that foster home. And I moved in with at that time, I had a high school sweetheart that I got with in like ninth grade. And she was my girlfriend all through high school. And I clung to her like she was my higher power. She was my everything, you know. And I moved in with her. She was 14 and I was 16. It's crazy. And I lived on their farm. And I milked the cows on the farm and the farmer's daughter, you know, basically. And I was milking 200 head of cattle, feeding, you know, 80 calves in the calf barn, feeding 20 heifers, and doing all this stuff from like 5 o'clock in the morning until like 8 o'clock, and I'd go to school. Then I'd come home from school and do it over again. And then I'd run off and go probably rehearse in some band, you know. So I did that, and once I graduated from high school, I didn't have any aspirations of going to college or anything like that. I just knew I had to work, I had to do something to be able to take care of myself, because no one was going to help me go to college or anything like that. And so I went into the military. I went into the Navy, you know, and I married that girl. You know, we got married. I was 19, she was 17. And her parents signed for her and everything, you know. They knew we were going to, you know, grow up and get married, you know. And so in the Navy, you know, when I was in high school, I was just doing what everybody else does. You know, we party, we'd go to kegger parties, we'd smoke a bunch of weed, we'd do this and that. I didn't consider myself, you know, out of control, or I didn't even think about having an alcohol or a drug problem or anything. I was just doing what everybody else does, you know. And I got into the Navy, and then the drinking started to kick up a notch, you know, because all we did, you know, when I was away, is we'd go to strip clubs and drink. You know, it was just strip clubs and alcohol, strip clubs and alcohol, you know, and I started to get, I would have really bad hangovers, but everybody did. That's what we all did. It's all sailors did that, you know. And I would just work hard, party hard. That's what I thought I was doing, you know. And that went on for a while, and I was still like, when I got into the Navy, another thing I was doing right when I first got into the Navy is also I got heavily into martial arts, right? So I was training really super hard in martial arts. I was training with a guy who was on the Navy Taekwondo team, and he was trying to be on the Olympic team, and I was right there with him, you know, trying to, I had aspirations of doing the same thing, you know. And I was just training my butt off to do that. And, you know, alcohol and drugs kind of just, at that point in my life, I still felt like I was going up. I had a lot of goals. I was doing good, but it was kind of stunning my growth. You know what I mean? It was kind of keeping me from, like, achieving the goals, you know, that I really could have. You know, that's all it was kind of doing then, you know? And so, you know, that went on for a while, and then it came time for me to get out of the military, get out of active duty. And right about that time when I was getting out of active duty, I went, okay, well, now I'm going to be a cop. I did a lot of weird stuff, man. But so I went through all the motions to become a cop. I got all accepted in the San Diego Police Department. I had a start date in the academy. I did everything, you know. And I came home one night, and my wife, she already had a bag packed, and she just goes, I don't love you anymore. And I just left right then. It was just gone. And went to Mexico with some other dude, you know. And that was like, I was like, that was devastated. You know, I would choose my whole world, you know. And that right then was like a turning point in my drinking, you know. I went into the hugest pity party you can imagine, you know. It was like a 2-year-long pity party, you know. And I was just drinking really heavy, sleeping around with all kinds of women, you know, doing what we do, trying to fix an inside problem with outside stuff, you know, just trying to fill that hole in my soul with outside stuff, but nothing was filling it, you know, nothing was working, right? We all, most of us all know that feeling, right? So I was doing that for, you know, at the same time while I was doing that, I got called back up for the first Gulf War. And I went back into the Navy. I got activated, and I went into a special warfare unit. You know, and that's when the Navy basically tried to drown me for a long time, you know. And I went through a bunch of trainings with the Marine Corps, and I did a whole bunch of stuff that scared the crap out of me, you know. I mean, I would get so scared, I would throw up on some of the stuff I had to do, you know, but I was forcing myself to fight through the fear and just do it, you know. And I did that for a while until it was time for, we were getting called to go to Iraq, and my date came up for me to get out. And I had to make a decision whether I was going to stay in and go over there or get out. And I was like, no, I'm out. Because there was too many guys that I knew that had died in training. I'm like, yeah, I don't want this, so I'm out. So I got out of the military then, and that was all right at the same time that she had left me, you know. And so everything was so bad in the San Diego area, and I was starting to drink really heavy. I did what we do, you know, I pulled the Geographic, you know. I mean, I'm going back up north where I was raised because, you know, things will be different there. You know, I got to get away from the people I'm partying with here and go up there. So I go up there, and I get into a rock band. First thing I do is I get into a rock band. I'm not working. I'm on unemployment. I'm selling weed for a living and playing in nightclubs, you know, for like a year. That was a pretty fun year, actually. And I'm just cruising along like this, and we're just drinking, partying, you know, and everything's just, you know, just doing what all my peers were doing, because, you know, what I didn't realize is what I was doing is I was seeking out the lower companionship like we talked about, you know. I was hanging out with the kind of people that are like me. That's what they do is party, you know, so I don't look so bad. And I don't realize how much I'm drinking, how much I'm using, how you know, promiscuous I'm being and sleeping with all these, you know, these different women. And just all the crazy debauchery that's going on, you know. I don't realize it. I don't see it, right? The denial is starting to set in already, right? I got denial that I'm in denial, you know. So that goes on for a while up there until I burn it down up there. So I moved back down here. I moved back down to Ventura, and I moved in with my cousin, who was a cocaine dealer. I thought that'd be a great idea, you know. Moved in with him, you know. He told me, you know, you need to be with your real family, you know. I love you, bro. You need to be with me, you know. And so I moved back down and moved in with him. And I get into another band down here, a band called Pitbull in Ventura. And same thing, you know, same thing. You know, I get a job because I'm teaching martial arts. I start teaching martial arts on the side. And one of the guys that I was teaching, his dad owned a telecommunications company. And he hired me and trained me to be a tech. And that's how I got into that field, you know. And so I just started doing that, playing in this band, and that's when I met my second wife. We always had like lots of wives and husbands, so that's when I met my second wife. And I've been going through all these women and just living this rock star life, you know. Just literally, it was drugs, sex, and rock and roll, you know. I thought I was living the life, you know, but I was getting really tired of it. You know, I was not feeling good about myself. It was shallow, you know. The relationships weren't relationships, you know. And then when I was in that band, this girl came around, and you know, I thought she was cute, and I'm asking about her. I'm like, hey, who's that chick? And my guitar player, like, you stay the hell away from her. She's a good girl. She doesn't, you know, she didn't like that, you know. So of course I got with her, and I married her. You know, I'm just fast forwarding this stuff so we get the good stuff. So I married her, and you know, I stayed in that band for a long time. I was working in the field. I worked for a big company. I worked for turning into WorldCom, it's turning into NCI, it was turning into Verizon, you know. But I was making good money, working hard, moved up here about 22 years ago, moved up to the Santa Maria area. And I was just doing that job, doing the deal, living the married life. I was drinking heavily on the weekends, you know, and then just drinking beer during the weekdays. You know, I thought I was managing and controlling my drinking, right? I'd have two or three beers. You know, I could come home after work and have a couple beers sometimes. And sometimes that might turn into six beers, you know what I mean? Sometimes a couple Coors Lights might turn into, you know, 40 Coors Lights, an 8-ball of cocaine, and 57 cigarettes later, you know what I mean? And you find yourself 6 a.m. the next morning all gacked out, you know, with a beer in one hand, a cigarette in the other, watching the normal people go to work, you know? And I've done that several times, and yeah, that's a horrible feeling, you know? But at the same time, I'm like living this double life. I'm trying to be a dad to my kids. I have two kids, you know, and I'm trying to be the dad that coaches the baseball team and does all the stuff for his kids, you know, because I have this thought in my head that I want to give my kids the life that I do not have, you know. And even though I was in my drinking and stuff, you know, I think I did that. You know, I think I did a pretty good job of doing that. I was able to get through that because luckily I got sober when they were around 12, 14 years old. But even up to that, it was super important to me to do the best that I could for my children, you know, because, you know, I think back at my childhood, and it just breaks my heart to think about, you know, I think when I view myself as that little terrified little boy, you know, and I wouldn't wish for any kid to go through that, you know. And so it was very important to me to be a good dad. But still, you know how this disease is. You know, even we can have all the great intentions we want, right? The intentions, the great intentions don't get me nowhere, you know what I mean? It takes action. But back then, I didn't know anything about any of that kind of stuff, you know? So I'm working for this big company, and we had this big bankruptcy. The company WorldCom, when it was a big, huge telecommunications bankruptcy, and they had been lying to all its employees, and we all lost all our 401ks and our stock options. They lost it all, you know. So I think back on this now, you know, and I had a really good resentment working towards that company, you know. And I worked along the, what happened, I'm getting into what happened now, so I worked along the railroad tracks. I did fiber optic networks. It was all along these railroad tracks up and down the beaches of Santa Barbara and California, up and down, you know. And one day, you know, I looked over the tracks, and I looked down there, and I saw these, you know, there was like these chicks laying out naked on the beach. You know, and I thought, oh, man, this is a great place for me, you know. And I started hanging out at these beaches during working hours when I was supposed to be working, right? And it was two parts. It was a full-on resentment towards the company, like, you know what? They owe me. You know, I lost my 401k, all my stock options. I'm just sitting down here hanging out on the beach, man, with my ice chest full of little whiskey shots and, you know, a bunch of Coors Lights and a bunch of Vicodin and some Viagra. I'm good to go, you know what I mean? That's definitely not a vision for you, you know what I'm saying? You know? So, you know, I'm ashamed to say this, and it does hurt me to say this, but I did that for like 15 years. You know, it's amazing. I mean, I did that for a long time. You know, and I don't know how in the hell I got away with that for that long. But, you know, I'd be down on the beach on my cell phone, you know, just kicking back with the, you know, on conference calls with directors and managers. And back then it was just Star 69. You mute your phone, you know, and they couldn't hear the waves crashing and stuff, you know. But so, you know, it just came to a point where I started to turn into the person that I didn't like. I was full of shame, full of guilt, and I was completely living a double life. Completely. I would be, you know, I didn't have no set hours at my job. I was on call 7x24, so I could have been working all night, and I'd still be on call the next day, and I'd be like, well, I'm just going to stay down here and hang out on the beach then, you know? And that just went on for a long time. And I hang out with guys, you know, I was the boss. And I had all these guys that worked for me, and we all drove these company trucks that looked exactly the same, you know, with no company logo on them. And we would just go hang out at bars. We would go hang out at bars during the day and drink. We'd get whatever we had to get done, do the minimum possible, and I got really good at my job, so I could do it really fast, bust out the work, get where we need, you know, we're going to the bar, where are we going to go hang out? And we'd sit there and drink. And we thought we were invincible because we're in company trucks and that's totally incognito and no one's ever gonna bust us, you know. And those guys were all hanging out at these same beaches as me, you know. We had, remember the Nextel, we had the walkie-talkie feature on it, you know, and I had these guys, you know, I'd be all, beep, beep, just Admiral Moody to Sergeant Buff, come on, where are you? You know, have you seen Private Parts anywhere? And, this guy, Private Parts, he's an idiot. But he's the reason I got busted. It wasn't my fault, and it wasn't that dang smiley face tattoo, it was Private Parts' fault. But, so what happened was on the weekends I would drink like so heavily and all it would take is whiskey. Once I took one shot of whiskey, it was it. And I was one of these drunks, you know, I'm a naked drunk, you know what I mean? I was just like, just add whiskey, I'm naked, everybody's single. You know, and I'm married at the time, you know. And that's just the way it was, man. It's just, you know, And it came to a point, you know, I had to concede to my innermost self, you know, if you wind up the only naked guy at the party, you might be an alcoholic. You know what I mean? If you wind up losing your job of 22 years because you were busted drunk on a nude beach, you might be an alcoholic, you know? And you might have some other issues working too, which I definitely did, you know? And if you wind up on the garage floor with a 9mm in one hand and a bottle of whiskey in the other, ready to kill yourself, but you don't have the guts to do it, you might be an alcoholic. And like, this guy back here, if you get kicked out of the midget convention, you might be an alcoholic. You know, all the crazy things we do, but we still don't see it. You know what I mean? We just don't see it. We're in denial, you know? All these crazy things are happening, and I didn't even have a thought of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Why would I want to hang out with a bunch of sober, boring people? You know what I mean? I wanted to party. You know what I mean? And I kept doing this stuff until it came to that point where I did get busted on that beach, and I did lose my job of 22 years, and I had to come home and tell my wife why I lost my job, you know? And that was gnarly. That, you know, it's kind of funny now, but it wasn't funny then, let me tell you. I had two young kids, you know? How selfish is that? I had these intentions of I want to give my kids the best life that I possibly could, but look what I was doing. You know, that's the disease of alcoholism that we just don't see. You know, that I just did not see or notice. I was caught up in these addictions. And it was horrible. It was tough, man. And I had this feeling over my head. I was just so embarrassed, so ashamed, because I was the boss. Everyone at the company knew. That industry was all the different big carriers that worked out there. They only saw my truck at the beach, you know, and they all knew I was there. And so I knew everyone was talking. And I had serious issues, man, and I wanted to die. I wanted to die. So what did I do? I drank for two or three more years. You know what I mean? I immediately went to work for Sprint and drank for two more years. Until it came to that point where I did not want to live anymore, you know. And my oldest son was probably 13, and my younger son was like 10, and I wanted to kill myself. I really did. I thought everybody would be better off without me. You know, I really did. I really felt that, and I remember that feeling. I always want to remember that feeling because that was a dark feeling, you know, and I felt that there was this dark cloud over my head that's never going to go away, you know, and how embarrassing, what did I turn into, man, what's wrong with me, you know, and my cousin, that cocaine dealer guy, he had been sober for 6 years during this time, you know, and my wife at the time had got the gun from the air, she called him. Got the gun for, you know, and I wasn't really going to do it. I didn't have the balls to do it, you know, but she got that away from me, called him, put him on the phone. And he gets on the phone and he goes, hey man, how much whiskey do you have left? You know, and I think I held my hand. I was like, this much? Well, I can't see your hands, moron. I'm left in the bottle. So I had a couple swigs, you know. And he's all, pound that right now. Just pound it. You never have to drink again. You never have to drink again. And he goes, I'm going to help you. This is it. This is enough. And he pushed. He's like, I'm done. He goes, I know you're done. You want to kill yourself. And he goes, we're going to get you help, man. Are you willing to get some help?
Yeah, man, I'll do anything.
You know, I was finally hitting my bottom. You know, I finally hit my rock bottom. And so he spent the next couple of days trying to find a treatment finish for me, right? And like about 6 months before that, my real father, who I didn't really know, he passed away. He died of cancer. And he didn't raise us. He was never there for us. But when I was 18 years old, I reached out, tried to find him, and tried to have a relationship with him, you know, and it would just be a phone conversation once in a while. But he raised these other three kids, and he always told those kids that you have two brothers. You know, and those kids always reached out to me. And I always thought, like, yeah, this is weird. What do you want from me? You know, and I always try to keep them at arm's length. But before he died, his son reached out to me and said, you know, he's dying. If you, you know, there's anything you want to do, if you could write him a letter or do anything, you know, it would be a good time because he doesn't have much time left. And so I wrote him a letter and I forgave him. I didn't know anything about forgiveness. You know what I mean? I hadn't come to you guys yet. I didn't know anything. I don't know why I did it. He nudged me to do it. So I did it. And he told me he read that to him. There was tears rolling down his eyes on his deathbed before he died. And we got to hear that. He got that letter. And when he died, the little bit of money that he had, he split between us, his three boys and me and my little brother, equal shares. So my cousin is trying to find me a treatment center, right? He can't find anything around here. He finally finds a place because he's like, you're sick, dude. You're like a triple threat. You got alcoholism, drug addiction, sex addiction. You got all kinds of problems, and you have all this childhood trauma. We need to find a place for you that would be a good fit for you. And so he finds a place in Kentucky. And it's called the Bridge to Recovery, and they deal with all that stuff, you know. And so they were full out there in Kentucky, and she said, look, it was like a Saturday, and she said, look, you could get him on a plane, and he could be to this new facility we just opened by 7:30 in the morning on Monday morning. We could take him because we're starting a new group. Have you ever heard of Santa Barbara? We just opened a new facility there. And you know, right then is where the start of, like, you know, God was doing for me right there what I couldn't do for myself. You know what I mean? It was just one of those things. And things just started lining up. And that money I was talking about that my real father left, they took that money as full payment for that treatment. So that money paid for my treatment to go there. You know, and it was only $7,000, and they cost $20,000. You know, my insurance wouldn't cover it. But they said, since we're a new startup, we'll take it and let you in. And we went, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, it was very, very awkward, very trippy. You know, first thing I got there, you know, it was mixed with men and women. First thing I got there, there was like three hot chicks there. I'm like, oh, yeah, I can do this. Let's just do this. Yeah. This ain't going to be so bad, you know? You know, and, but I quickly learned, you know. And we did all kinds of crazy stuff in that treatment facility, man. I had to carry around a little stuffed animal, my inner child. Here I am, you know, thinking I'm all tough guy, carrying around this little teddy bear, you know. Yeah, that's little Kevin, you know. It was crazy, man. They did all the guided meditation and have us take that and talk about taking care of your inner child inside of yourself, you know, which I really needed, man. I really needed to humble myself and do this, you know, because I wanted to die. I didn't have any other option, you know. And they brought people in from Alcoholics Anonymous and taught us about the steps. They had this therapy where they gave us baseball bats and they had these big, like, foam cubes, like a couch cushion thing, you know, about this tall and was square and they got handles on it. And they gave us baseball bats and had us just beat the crap out of that and just yell and scream at the people, like the people that were molesting me, you know, and all that, to just get all that out. It was just all this crazy therapy, but man, it really worked. I needed it, you know, and it helped me tremendously. So then, you know, they told me, what's your plan when you get out of there? You know, you had to come up with a plan of the meeting plan. How many meetings are you going to go to? What are you going to do, you know? And I'm like, oh, I'll probably go to like two meetings a week or something, you know. I got stuff to take care of, you know. I got shit to do, you know what I mean? I got kids, I got a family, you know. So I came to you guys, man. I came to you guys right here in Santa Maria, Lion's Den. You know, Lion's Den. I came to you guys. I got a, I, I did a bunch of things that I wasn't comfortable doing, you know, that I didn't want to do. You know what I mean? I was terrified. I was afraid of alcohol. You know, I'd walk into a bar and see all that, the mirror and all the bottles and everything. It just scared the crap out of me. I mean, that happened at a bowling alley once, you know. We went bowling, and I just saw all that alcohol. It just freaked me out, man. I just had to get out of there immediately. So I knew, you know, I was in trouble. I needed to do something, you know. And I came here and I worked these steps, man. I got a sponsor right off the bat, you know. And I started going to meetings every day. He told me to go 90 and 90. 90 meetings in 90 days, you know. Get service commitments. So I got service commitments. I had a bunch of service commitments, man. I chaired a convention at 5 years sober, I think. You know, I had all kinds of secretary commitments. So I was going to a bunch of meetings and just doing what was suggested of me. You know, and I remember my sponsor, Jason, used to always, you know, ask me to do all this crazy stuff. You know, like, what are you doing today? I'm all, not much. I'm just kicking back, working from home. He's like, you get paid for eight? You don't even have to work? I'm all, yep. Go down to the north side of town and give a homeless guy money. I'm like, huh? Why in the hell would I do that? He's just going to go buy alcohol or drugs with it. And he goes, that's none of your business. That's between him and God. Maybe he needs that alcohol. You know, just do it. And don't tell me about it afterwards. I don't want to know whether you did it or not. Don't tell nobody. That's between you and God. You know, so I would do it. I just do it, you know. In the beginning, I needed that tough, rigid sobriety. You know, some people need that, you know, be loved until you love yourself and soft and all that. I needed, because I was an ego guy, you know, I needed that tough. I needed those dudes to say, hey, you know, this is what we do. You know what we got? Do what we do. You know, and that's what I did, man. And my life has become, you know, an Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just, it's amazing. The changes that have happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. The things we do, the things we get to do, you know, and the more I stay sober, the longer I stay sober, the more I look back and see and realize the changes, you know, like more will be revealed all the time. More stuff gets revealed, you know. More stuff gets revealed all the time, you know. That my cousin who got me into that treatment center, you know, he became a drug and alcohol counselor, right? And he worked in all these big fancy treatment centers, you know. And then slowly, you know, that became his recovery. You know, he stopped going to meetings. He stopped being a sponsor, you know. And like about 6 months ago, 16 years of sobriety, he drank. You know, so now he's out, you know. And guess what he's calling? He's calling me now. You know, so I get to be that guy for him now. You know, when he's going through it, you know, but that's the way this thing works, you know. I'm not above, I don't think anybody in this room is above getting loaded, right? I mean, have you ever heard anybody share, you know, I do everything my sponsor asks of me. You know, I go to meetings, I pray, I meditate, I work the steps, you know, I'm working with others, and I got loaded. I've never heard that. Ever. But I hear all the time, you know, I hear all the time that I stopped going to meetings, I stopped working with a sponsor, and I got loaded. I mean, you hear it all the time. Last night, I had to, you know, it was an honor to hear the two Kathys get up here and speak and just do a great job, man. And I was like, I was touched. I was like, wow, that's a miracle, man. You know, there's miracles all around this room, you know. You look around this room and just think of where we came from and what we used to be and what we are now. It's amazing, you know. I think God's fingerprints are all over this program, you know. And you know, that's the thing about, the beautiful thing about this thing, too, is we all have our own higher power. We all have our own God, you know. My God is Jesus Christ, you know. I like to think of myself as a soldier in Christ's army, you know. But that kind of sounds cool, too. I'm a soldier for Christ.
Yeah.
That sounds tough. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and if you're newer, you're newer, and you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, you know,
and you're honest, you don't have to want to do fun, you cannot quit entirely,
you know. I tried switching, I did all that stuff, switched to just beer. I'm just going to drink beer, so I had that first shot of whiskey. Right, and then it's it. I don't know what, it's just, I'm off and running, I'm done. I don't know what's going to happen. I couldn't understand that either, you know what I mean? They make the top of those whiskey bottles small, fit in your mouth for a reason, you know? One thing you can hold it good, and I never understood this kind of drinker I was. I didn't understand, why would you pour it into another glass and then drink it? I mean, why would you do that, you know? It's just like, this is perfect drinking receptacle right here, you know? And I keep it with me at all times, you know, and hide it wherever I want to. Because that was a big thing I was doing towards the end, too. I had little whiskey bottles hid all over my garage. And I'd be out there at 6 a.m. in the morning, you know, that's what it got to towards the end, you know. I'd be out there at 6 a.m. in the morning in the garage, looking both ways, make sure my kids and my wife's not up, so I could, you know, pull off that bottle, you know. I had this buddy that lived across the street from me. That he was an alcoholic. I was an alcoholic. You know, and him and I would drink every weekend. We'd just get stupid drunk, and then we'd jump in the car and drive to Elmer's about midnight, 12:30, 1 o'clock. Then we'd roll in there after the wife fell asleep, and we'd try to push our cars down the street so they wouldn't hear the car going. We'd push it down the street away and then jump in it and drive off all laughing, all wasted, you know. But we used to do that all the time. But he'd only bring one beer over to my house at a time. He lived directly across the street from me. And he would say, this way, I go, well, dude, why do you only bring one beer? Just bring the whole freaking, you know, 30-pack. You're going to be here all night drinking, just like always. And he goes, well, this keeps me from getting too hammered. And so by the end of the night, you know, he'd come back and he'd be all... He'd come back, and one time he came back, he's got a black eye. Well, you would have it. You just went home to get a beer. He's all, I was pissed. You know, I was opening the gate, and it just hit me in the face, you know. Another time he came back, his whole face, side of his face was all scratched up, and he's all, I don't know what happened, man. The street just, like, came up and hit me in the face. You know, and I'm all, man, you're messed up. You're an alcoholic, bro. And I remember he busted me. He, you know, the reason why I'm telling this is because, you know, I would look at everybody else, you know, they had a problem like that, and never look at myself, you know. And he busted me pounding that whiskey bottle one morning in the garage. And I remember him looking at me and saying, if you're going to drink like that, I'm not going to hang out with you anymore. Come on, me, you're the alcoholic. What are you talking about, you know? But that's how bad I got, you know. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I found, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is, you know, I think God had a hand on Alcoholics Anonymous, but I think Alcoholics Anonymous brought me closer to God. I really do. Because I was, you know, doing all that when I was living a double life and doing all that and hanging out at these beaches and running around acting like a dummy, I was going to church. I was on the worship team. I was playing in the band. You know what I mean? I was full on double life. I was the dad and Lord here explaining myself, you know? And I was still doing that. And that wasn't fixing my problem. It wasn't fixing my problem. But I came here and I believed in God, right? I just thought God didn't believe in me anymore, you know? But when I came here, I was able to develop a relationship with God. A strong relationship with God, a loving God, not a God of brimstone and fire, not a damning God, you know, a God that loves me, you know, and a God that forgives me. And I learned in here that if God can truly forgive me, then I can forgive me. And then if I can forgive me, then I can forgive you. And I can let go of these resentments I had grown, you know. I mean, that's the beauty of the step work and good sponsorship, you know. Those are the kinds of things that I learned in here that just literally saved my life, you know. And I heard Joanne after the, I'm not Joanne, I'm sorry. Marianne after the meeting, talking to a newcomer out there. And she goes, you know, I don't have to live in fear anymore because I live in action. And I was like, boom. I'm going to say that tomorrow night. So there I said. You know, these little gems that you hear from each other. You know, I heard Colin come and say to him after a meeting one night, he said, yeah, my ears never got me in trouble, but my mouth sure does, you know. And she's opening up the system. You know, and all these great things we learned that my sponsor taught me. You know, do you want to be happy or do you want to be right? Right? It's not about what you say, it's about what you do. You know? All those little things. And this one, I love this one. It's none of your damn business what other people think about you. That one, you know, I took a while to wrap my head around that one. I'm like, what do you mean? Yeah, it is. What are you talking about? And my cousin, you're such a damn control freak, Golden. What are you going to do? Climb on their head and tell them how they should be thinking? You know, control their thoughts? It's none of your business what other people think about you. And that was a really hard one for me to wrap my head around. But I get it today. I get it today. You know, I get these things today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just rambling now, man. Preach it, brother. So, I'm going to just wrap this up. And I'm going to read something to you guys. And I'm just going to end with this. Out of the big book, page 420. Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for Him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him. However it turns out, that's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind off my acceptance and off my on my acceptance and off my expectations. For my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see that I've never had it so good. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah.